Everyone is talking about this. The true story of a rape case is written by mother and teacher Lisa Lennox. On one ordinary July evening in 2021, the lives of Lisa and her family were turned upside down when her 17-year-old daughter Beatrice, or Bea as she prefers to be known, became the victim of one of the worst crimes that can befall anyone. What follows is the story of the aftermath of this horrific event as Lisa, her husband Phil, youngest daughter Iris, and of course and most importantly Bea herself, are forced to navigate the police and the legal system in their fight for justice. Please be aware that this audiobook contains references to rape, sexual assault, mental health conditions, and eating disorders. There is also occasional strong language. August drags slowly on. I buy ant powder for the infestation in the garden and happen to start my onslaught on the very day the flying ants emerge. I take a terrible, sadistic pleasure in wiping out the colony and preventing the queen flying off with her lieutenants. It's not that big a deal for the latter. They only live for a few days anyway. The queen, on the other hand, can survive and colonize for up to 15 years. Not this little lady, I think, my teeth set in a rigid grimace, my eyes half closed to protect against the winged beasts. Every death is a revenge for Beatrice, for Miss Truman's father, for Sarah Everard, Bieber Henry, Nicole Smallman. An ant for a human life or human trauma. How pathetic. Perhaps I'm deranged, I think, as I fling the killer powder around. How do you know if you've gone mad? In an attempt to console myself, I turn, as I always do, to my sewing machine. There's something in the slow, calm rhythm of laying out the pattern pieces onto the fabric, cutting, marking, sewing, pressing, that takes away the need to focus on anything else. I sew and I sew whenever I have a spare moment, when the girls are in bed until midday, and I don't have the energy to urge them to get up. And anyway, what would they be getting up for? Another sullen summer day when the sun barely shows behind the clouds doesn't seem worth the effort. I don't hear anything from David about the personal security alarm. I say to Bea that I'm cross she hasn't been given it yet, and she tells me that David has been in communication with her about it. I'm surprised. I didn't know. I text him and ask him to call me. He does, and I tell him I would like to be included. I have to respect Beatrice's privacy, he responds. I get that, I say. But I have to protect her vulnerability, so please just keep me in the loop. The social worker comes and takes Bea out for walks, and I have to grit my teeth and bear it for want of knowing what they are talking about. On each visit, if she actually enters the house, she asks to see Bea's bedroom, which is gradually filling up with more and more discarded clothing. Despite the amount of garments on the floor, Beatrice has a meltdown about not having anything to wear. Nothing fits, everything has holes or stains or missing buttons or drawstrings. For years, all she has worn is joggers, t-shirts, hoodies, and Nike Air Force Ones. The latter I have had to replace, as we have no idea when we will get back the brand new ones the police took away in the evidence bag. That is easily, though expensively, done. It was my favourite hoodie, Beatrice moans, mourning the clothes she has lost. And the joggers, they were the only ones I really liked that fitted me and were the right colour. I can't remember what colour they were. Surely we can buy another pair, I suggest. As many pairs as you want, I add in desperation as tears pour down Beatrice's paper-white cheeks. But the nice ones cost so much and it's your money and you don't have that much of it, she sobs. It's okay, I reassure her. I can find the money. There's always a bit spare for a rainy day. I have a small amount in a savings account in case I lose my job or some other catastrophe befalls us. I don't want to take money out of it, but I can. Then I check myself. Surely this is the very catastrophe I've been saving for, not the redundancy, house burning down, fatal accident or illness catastrophe I imagined, but one I could never have dreamt of. I pick up my phone and transfer £250 from my savings account into my current account. It's that easy. Let's get online, I say to Beatrice. We spend hours trawling websites, Beatrice getting more and more tense by the minute, snapping at everything I suggest, sobbing anew when something she likes the look of is not available in her size. Several times we put something in our basket, and it immediately disappears and goes out of stock. Why do they still have it on the website if you can't buy it? She wails. She's taking it personally, as if her life depends on the right hoodie and the right joggers. But of course it's not that. Her life depends on getting over this terrible harm that has been done to her. And as she cries and cries beside me, I'm starting to lose faith that I can help her. Beatrice's outpatient counsellor from the eating disorders clinic tells me privately that she'll go on seeing Bea even after she turns 18 next month, when she should officially be discharged and transferred to adult services if necessary. But, Julia explains, though she wants to carry on helping Bea, she's not an expert in sexual assault. It doesn't matter, I tell her. Bea trusts you and you have a relationship with her. I think that's the most important thing. The weather continues dull and rainy, dragging spirits down with it. I'd booked tickets for Iris and I to swim at the Lido on the last Friday in August, but on the day it's too cold and wet to go. I'm as game as the next 50-year-old mum, but an unheated pool with no shelter in the pissing rain is not my idea of fun at the best of times, and these are the worst of times. I tell Iris and she cries. Beatrice is in her room, probably also crying. I want to cry too, but I can't. Apart from having to put on a brave face for the girls, I've run out of energy for tears. What's the point of crying when it won't change anything? Kaylee calls. She's setting up the end-of-plan meeting for Beatrice for when she turns 18. She wants the school, the police, the voluntary organisation I've signed Bea up with, me, Beatrice and Julia to be there, as well as her own manager. Good luck with coordinating that, I mutter under my breath. She asks for David's email address, and I tell her that I don't have it, but I wish I did, because we're still trying to get the personal alarm for Beatrice. It's now 4 weeks since the attack, and that seems a long time to wait. On the one hand, what does it matter? Beatrice is not going out unless it's with me. But on the other hand, she'll never have the courage to go out without me until she has this alarm. In the silent watches of the night, I go over and over the event again and again, and Beatrice's interview, whether she said the right things, made it clear she did not consent to sex, could not have done so in such a situation. What if the jury don't believe that it's rape if she didn't fight or scream, if she didn't come out of it bloodied and bruised, physically hurt as well as mentally? At 2 a.m. I'm up, creeping out of the bedroom, tripping over Tiggy, who's heard me move and hopes it's breakfast time, finding my laptop, googling rape and consent for the millionth time, scrolling through the pages. The law does not require the victim to have resisted physically in order to prove a lack of consent. It's there, in black and white. This should do it, shouldn't it? But the problem still remains that there's no evidence. No actual evidence, and there never will be, because Bea and Mr. Y were the only people who were there, and so it's one person's word against another. Bea is telling the truth, and Mr. Y is lying. But who will a jury believe? The girls go back to school and I go back to work. This is a logistical nightmare, as we cannot let them walk to the tube station alone, and both start at different times and therefore don't travel together. And anyway, Bea can't go anywhere near our closest tube station anymore, so the whole journey is longer and more complicated. We end up with an arrangement where I take Iris and then continue to my work, and Phil takes Bea and then continues to his work. On the way back, we tell them to get off the tube at an earlier stop and take the bus the rest of the way, as it brings them to within a minute of the house, and there are always lots of people who get off at our stop and walk in the same direction as us. Shortly after term begins, we have the final meeting with Kaylee, and she says she will send through a copy of her report. At work, I'm preparing some lessons on Webster's Duchess of Malfi. The Duchess is clarion call, as she is about to die. I am Duchess of Malfi still. Reverberates around my mind. She is a woman in a man's world, finding her way, coping with abusive brothers who try to control her, seeking love in a marriage that must remain a secret, as the man she adores is far beneath her in status. It never ends, I think. It was happening 400 years ago, male oppression and violence towards women, and it's happening now. And when will it ever end? When I get home, Kaylee has hand-delivered her report. I'm stunned by how detailed it is, how thorough and fluently written. The report gives me information I had not had before. The name of the investigating officer, DC Megan Wade, as well as the overseeing DS, Luke Gallagher. It also details some more information about Beatrice's sexual history, or lack of it, and the attack itself. Beatrice remembers kissing, which makes me recoil in disgust. It states that police are satisfied that no one else is involved, other than the one person currently in custody. I would have liked to have heard that last detail from the police themselves, and I'd still like to have David's email address. I write to Luke Gallagher, whose email address is on the report, listing my concerns as follows. I have read that it's essential that the jury hear from experts who can dispel rape myths before hearing from the victim. Can we be sure this will happen? I understand that sexual history is often not allowed to be referenced, but in this case I think it's essential that it is, chiefly for the fact that B has none. She has handed her phone over for download, and incidentally not been given it back. Has Mr. Y? Why were we not offered a female SOAT? When will we get the alarm app? I add at the end my continued request that communication comes to me as well as, or instead of, Beatrice, as she's young and vulnerable and a teenager, so not only will she ignore anything difficult or uncomfortable, she'll generally take time getting round to dealing with whatever she is sent. And anyway, I need to know because anything that's triggering might set her off, might make her do something stupid. So please, please communicate via me. I press send before I can think better of it. Frankie cautioned me about contacting the police in case of alienating them, but I have to do what I can. To my slight surprise, D.S. Gallagher is responsive. Come to a meeting, he says. So the following weekend, Phil and I set off once more to the police station. We're building a case, explains Luke. We're deep within the building, in a small, windowless interview room, with only enough light for me to just about see my notebook to write in. Then, once we've done that, we have to give everything we've got to the defence. It's the nature of the game. It's a game? The phrase doesn't seem appropriate, but I don't question it out loud. What was this guy doing there, I ask. The grass behind the nursery school does not even have any benches. It's not an attractive place to hang out. Well, it's a place where people meet to drink, states Luke airily with a shrug of his shoulders. I stare at him open-mouthed. We've lived in our house for almost 15 years, I counter. I've used that road umpteen times at all hours of the day and night, and I have never, ever, ever seen people hanging out and drinking there. There's nowhere to sit down apart from anything else. Luke sighs ruefully and gives me a look that says he wishes he didn't have to shatter my naivety. The search officers found scores of cans, he says. And then Phil interjects. Well, yes, I suppose there would be, he agrees. I whip my head around to Phil so fast I'm surprised it doesn't fly off my neck and launch across the room. What do you mean? Well, the drinking, it's true, he says. What do you mean? I demand. You mean you've seen young men, alkies, druggies, hoodies, whatever, hanging around there, drinking? Because I never have. And if you have, why did you never say? Why did you let our girls walk that road, if you knew? If you knew it was dangerous? Why? Phil looks confused. Well, I mean, I didn't think it was dangerous. I'm just agreeing with Luke that cans were found there. I stare at him in utter bemusement. I don't know what you're talking about. Did you, or did you not, know that undesirables hung around there drinking? Do you actually think that they do? Because I don't. Now Phil is looking uncomfortable. He shifts in his seat. I'm suddenly acutely aware of Luke sitting there listening, possibly filing this altercation away. Erratic parents, careless parents, arguing parents, unfit parents. Parents who don't know the criminality that lies on their own doorstep, who can't keep their children safe, who don't keep their children safe. I modulate my voice and decide I'll finish this discussion with Phil later. I walk past the area regularly, I say calmly. I noticed, a week or so after the attack, that all the undergrowth had been cut down, so that now you can actually see a lean-to on the back of the school, and a high window on the adjoining house that I never even knew existed. So I'm guessing that many of the cans that were found might be ages old. There are no litter bins in the vicinity, so I suppose passers-by throw their trash into the bushes instead. I want to make clear that this is not a known drinking den, that of all the many, many friends and acquaintances of ours who live in the area, no one has ever said, don't walk that road, it's dangerous. I've never felt in any danger there. So we had absolutely no reason not to let Beatrice walk up that road on a summer's evening. There's a pause after my mini-speech. I'm not sure who I'm more angry with. Luke for insinuating Beatrice was somewhere she shouldn't be, or Phil for making it seem as if we live in the hood. Moving on, I say, why has she still not got the alarm? There have been some teething problems, replies Luke. Fuck, teething problems. This is my daughter's life, her safety, I remind Luke. To this I get no response. I ask about a female sewer, and he tells me, with an air of being affronted, that I should make such a request, as if it's a slur on David, that they don't have enough. Simple as. I ask about the defendant's phone. Yes, they have it, but getting translations, etc. takes some time. Probably sensing that I'm taking too much of the initiative, Luke asks his own question. You've been told that we'll have to have access to all of B's medical records, he says. Oh yes, I reply, trying, not very hard, to keep the sarcasm out of my voice, and failing, so that it's a fair trial. The words hang for a moment, waiting for a reaction. All they get is a patronising smile from Luke. And what if we refuse access to them? I ask. Luke casts his eyes regretfully downwards. The CPS will drop the case, most likely. Disbelief stuns me into a rare silence. The thing is, I flounder, I simply don't understand what could be relevant. What does it matter that she saw the doctor for a verruca when she was 10? It's ridiculous, irrelevant. I don't reinitiate the conversation with David about prior complaints of being raped. It's clear that in the UK you have one chance, and one chance only, of bringing a rape case, and woe betide anyone for whom it happens more than once. Which is insane, because there must be many women to whom it has happened more than once. Maybe not stranger rape, but date rape. I find out later, from Rape Crisis's website, that 1 in 2 adult survivors of rape have indeed experienced it more than once. I don't say any of this, but instead focus on Luke's answer. Well, he's saying, the records might be relevant if, for example, she'd discussed with her counsellor having rape fantasies. The room spins around me. Wait, what? I interject. Did you honestly just say that? Luke shrugs. Some people do. I'm flabbergasted. I don't know where to begin with my response to this. One, Luke is suggesting that if someone has ever in their life thought about or talked about rape, they can't actually be raped. Two, B's a child. She's had no sexual experience whatsoever. And she's anorexic. The only thing she's been fantasizing about for the last 2 or 3 years of her life is starving herself to death. And on top of all of this, it's not a crime to fantasize about rape. It's a crime to commit rape. I take a deep breath. Do you really think that 17-year-old girls, especially girls like B, spend a lot of time fantasizing about being raped, I ask? And that if she had, which she hasn't, but if she had, that it could be used against her? It's the law. I seize my bottle of water and take a long slug. I need to cool down, literally. So, rape fantasies aside, how's the case looking overall? I've learnt not to second-guess a jury, replies Luke. You simply never can tell. I've seen cases that look like they're open and shut result in not guilty. I've seen people convicted with the flimsiest of evidence. You just can't predict how it'll go. But surely, I press him, a young girl, on her own, a random stranger, surely they'll see she would never have agreed, could never have agreed, freely and fairly and by choice, that he's lying. Luke considers this momentarily. You'll always get jury members who go into the courtroom with a fixed idea and they're not going to change their minds for anybody's money. I've seen many cases scuppered by obstinacy and obduracy. But it's their job, I insist. It's the juror's job to listen to the evidence and make their conclusion. We don't have any actual evidence that Beatrice did not consent, says Luke. All we can do is hope to build a picture that suggests that she didn't. But if someone on the jury is convinced that it's not rape unless she yells and fights, well... Luke shrugs and tuts as if it's regretful but inevitable that someone will think this way. I clench my fists. I had convinced myself that the law would prevail against such opinions, that all the stuff I had read in the CPS, what is consent document, actually counted for something. But perhaps it doesn't, can't, won't. There are also those who hate the police and the system and won't ever find anyone guilty because they don't want someone going to prison on their say-so. Luke is chuntering on, oblivious to my reaction. There's nothing you can do about people like that. He sighs a world-weary sigh and grimaces. Now I want to scream. But that's why I said there needs to be someone to explain all of that, to dispel those myths and stereotypes. Everyone knows many, maybe even the majority, of rape victims freeze, go numb, go along with it to save themselves from getting hit or strangled or whatever. It's all over the CPS website and documents, I remind him. The prosecution and defence will agree some parameters at the beginning, explains Luke. But it's the jury we have to convince, not each other. And you're saying some will just decide what they think happened, irrespective of what's said in court, I demand. It often seems that way, yes. So what's the point of having a jury at all, then? I can't believe what Luke is saying, so deadpan, as if it wasn't my daughter's future at stake. If they don't actually do their job, and you know they're not doing their job, but you can't do anything about them not doing their job, what's the point? That's our legal system, trial by jury, innocent until proven guilty. Don't tell me, I say. It's all in the interests of a fair trial. It's Saturday night and I always make pad thai for supper with tofu. When we get home, I place the heavy kilo weight I found when digging the flower beds in the back garden on top of the plate to squash the excess water out of the tofu. If the man who raped my daughter were here, in front of me, would I bash his head in with this weight? I can't say that I definitely would, but I can't say I definitely wouldn't either. I collect the spring onions, peppers and carrots from the fridge, plus a gnarled end of pungent ginger root and a handful of garlic cloves. As I chop the veg and pile it into a bowl ready for cooking, grate the ginger, press the garlic and pulse the peanuts, the words of D.S. Luke Gallagher run round and round in my mind. You can never tell with a jury. I've learnt not to second-guess a verdict. Some people won't change their minds for anybody's money. The sense of frustration is overwhelming, as is that of despair. Is it worth pursuing this prosecution? Would it be better to walk away now, write it off, try to move on and forget? How can we have a system that's so broken it's making me think this way? So stacked against the victim at every turn, because apparently that's fair. Above all else, how will I explain to Beatrice that the man who raped her, whose actions have done a great job of ruining her life, might well walk free.